Episode 206 of Bustin' Loose Baseball coming your way after the Nats take 2 out of 3 from the Mets. You'll hear an interview we did with Mackenzie Gore this week. You'll also hear our breakdown of what's going right for the Nats offensively, a big swing from James Wood that could get him right, and a dive into the minor leagues as well. Let's get it started on Bustin' Loose Baseball.
Bustin' Loose Baseball, hosted by Grant Paulson and Toby Altizer, gives you in-depth analytics and interviews on everything baseball in the nation's capital. Now, here's your host, Grant Paulson and Toby Altizer.
This is Bustin' Loose Baseball. I'm Grant Paulson, joined as always by Toby Altizer, producer Darris Dameron alongside Toby. Why don't we start with the finale today as we record on Thursday evening. What a series for the Nats to take 2 out of 3 from the Mets, who are trying to keep a wild card spot. 9 runs on 9 hits, huge 3-hit performance from Brady House, 3 balls barreled over 97, 2 balls over 100, including a double off the top of the wall at 112. Riley Adams continues to produce as well, and a big 3-run home run from James Wood to save an 0-for-4 with 3 strikeouts. What had been an ugly day at the plate for him turned into a productive one, with a 100-mile-per-hour fastball at the letters taken out to the opposite field. Bullpen, 4 2/3, 1-hit innings with 6 strikeouts. Ferrer continues to shove in the closer's role. When Beeter throws strikes, he looks like a late-inning arm. There was a lot to like in this game.
Yeah, I mean, it's really nice to see this ball club go out there and be competitive against teams that are fighting for things. You saw it in the Phillies series where they're able to split with them, and then the Mets take the first game of this series, and you're like, okay, maybe they're going to be back to their losing ways, and the Nationals find a way to scratch across enough to win game 2 of the series, getting 5 runs off Senga, one of them unearned, but finding a way to get 5 across on a really tough pitcher in Senga, and then finding a way to make things work against Manaea, and then getting to Stanek to add some extra runs late in this ballgame. It was really nice to see young guys coming through. You mentioned Brady House with the 3-hit performance. It gotten to a point with him where you're wondering, okay, is it, you know, you're not going to make any sort of move, but, you know, do you need to look at some changes and figure out some things? And they'd already kind of trying to pick their spots and where they're playing them and stuff. He kind of struggled a little bit, but to see him come through with 3 hits, you mentioned the Wood homer. You know, anybody that's trying to sound the alarms on him, just relax. He's going to figure things out. He'll get things going in the right direction. But again, I hate always pointing out the Dylan Cruz corollary, but I think when he's in the lineup, I think him along with some of the other young guys, the way that they play the game is infectious, and there's just a confidence when they take the field. And maybe it's a bit of a blind confidence, because frankly, you look at the lineup they put out on Thursday, not overly impressive. I mean, we were talking about it in the press box, looking at their 3-4-5 of, what was it, DeYoung, Adams and Chaparro, is not exactly a intimidating lineup, but they find a way to scratch runs across because I think the guys believe that they can win, and that's led by guys like Dylan Cruz. And so having him back in the lineup, we were talking about Brady House a little bit, having a little bit of that winning player type mentality. They're making the smarter plays. They're going to still have to grow over a course of 162. You can't trot out this sort of a lineup that you saw on Thursday and turn into a winning ball club, but when you have belief from the guys, you can find ways to win games like you saw this afternoon at Nationals Park. And I think it's good to see that they're going to have more of these games down the stretch where they face ball clubs that are fighting for things, because frankly, the rest of this season for the Nationals obviously isn't about wins and losses to the extent that it is for other teams. But I think this is good experience for guys going through it for the first time, a full 162, and also facing teams that are fighting for things and trying to play spoiler, and that maybe being some of the motivation. So good to see them come out in a series against the Mets, a team that have been scuffling. You lose game 1, but then you get right back on the horse and win games 2 and 3, and it looked much more like a ball club that you feel confident can build on these sorts of performances going into next year versus a club that kind of sucked a little bit of life out of the fan base for a long time.
I mean, the heart of the order, 3-4-5 of DeYoung, Chaparro, Adams is probably like a 100-loss team over 162 offensively. But, you know, in a vacuum in this game, 9 runs on 9 hits, right? Going back through some of the guys to call attention to, I wasn't, it sounds like maybe as concerned about what we'd seen from House as maybe you were and others. But look, he's struggling. I mean, this is going to happen. When you call up 22-year-olds to play on bad teams in bad lineups, in clubhouses where they're playing out the string and there's not a lot of big league veteran talent, this is quite literally the expectation for me. Now, you'd like the one gripe, I guess, would be with Brady is that the slug has not been what you'd want it to be, right? The power, especially both home runs coming in the same game now, almost 50 games and 175 at bats in. I don't have any issues or concerns long term about his power. That's the least of my concerns. But a 326 slug at this point is frustrating. But to see him barrel three balls, hit a ball off the top of the wall, that was really, really good to see. Jose Ferreira, I wanted to talk about. His last 15 appearances now, he's got a 1.62 ERA, seven straight scoreless outings. He's been a different guy, Toby, since they gave him this ninth inning role. Kyle Finnegan traded to Detroit. By the way, he's been spectacular with the Tigers. That would be worth a podcast at some point, how all the Nats are faring that got traded. Finnegan's been awesome. Alex Cole just hit the longest home run this season by a Dodger. Like, no Freddie Freeman or Shohei Ohtani. Homer has gone deeper. All those superstars.
Who had that, by the way?
I know, right? Nate Lowe's first game, literally, as a Boston Red Sox at Fenway Park. He hit a game-tying two-run home run in the ninth inning, which created bedlam there. Go round and around. Like, there's all kinds of different guys we could talk about. But that said, Ferreira's handled so well this promotion, so to speak. You look at some of the particulars. I've been arguing with people about him all year, and I was loud wrong early because he really struggled, and I kind of thought he was going to be lights out. But to me, this is Blake Treinen all over again, where Nats fans hate a guy's guts because he doesn't perform. The problem with that is that the stuff is there. It's obvious. Anyone who, you know, watches baseball can see that this is a very rare pitch mix. It's a sinker at 98 on average with a changeup at 88. He touches 100, 101 regularly. His peripherals, he's 94th percentile with fastball velo, doesn't walk anybody less than 5% of the time. Barrel percentage rate is 97th percentile. Ground ball percentage is 99th percentile. He is going to be really, really good, and you're starting to see him turn it around. And that's what the second half is going to be about. Like, guys that get bigger roles, how do you handle it? Can you take advantage? Another guy in this capacity is Riley Adams with this ever-evolving, ongoing, like, never-ending K-Bert Ruiz recovery, and it's a scary thing when you're dealing with concussion stuff. Adams is actually getting to play more than he ever has on a daily basis, essentially. And he's hitting .318 this week. He over 15 games is hitting .326 with an OPS upwards of .850. Over 30 games, he's hitting .260, which is like 20 points above big league average, with an OPS right around .760 or something like that. So, I mean, Adams is actually performing. He's occasionally throwing guys out. So to see the bullpen having a nice run here, Ferrer on the back end throwing the way he is, Adams who's helping them out offensively, they're getting more to the catching position than they have. You know, those are all things as the year's gone on where you're seeing some guys really take advantage of a chance.
So with Ferrer, going back to him real quick, I almost wonder if he was someone that needed that little extra added responsibility, little kick in the pants, little bit of, hey man, I'm throwing you into the fire, figure it out sort of mentality. Cause you know, we talked to people in spring training and he was someone that everybody raved about, the ability and the stuff that he had. And, you know, people were saying he's got what it takes to be a big league closer, not just in terms of the stuff. And that's obvious, but also the mentality and kind of just that bulldog type of thought process. And you almost wonder if just kind of not having a defined role and going all over the place, and he was the eighth inning guy to an extent, he was obviously a leverage arm, but now having that closer title, do you almost wonder if that adds a little bit? It reminds me a little bit a couple years ago when CJ was kind of going through it. Davey called him into his office and said, hey man, you're now the leadoff hitter, and this is what this means. And CJ started to play a little bit better when he had some of that responsibility thrown on his plate, because I think it made him respond. I almost wonder if Ferrer has a little bit of that in him. He's shown the stuff all year, but the consistency and the stuff that we've seen since he's kind of been in that closer role, it hasn't been like that all year long. So I think it's going to be something to monitor down the stretch, and he's someone that I think is going to be a big part of the Nats' future in that bullpen. It's good to see him step up in those big spots. But you talked about Riley Adams. He's another one that's interesting where they played K-Bert Ruiz so much early in the season. Too much, frankly. And I don't even think that's debatable. They played him every day, it felt like. And so it's a good thing for K-Bert when he's going well, but also a bad thing because now you're running him into the ground and he's struggling to stay healthy. This concussion thing is kind of scary, honestly, the fact that it continues to linger like it is, and it feels like we never get updates on how he's doing. But part of the other detriment of playing him every day on top of wearing down K-Barrett is the fact that Riley Adams essentially has to go through spring training again in the month of May, June, and July to figure out how to play baseball again, because he didn't get at-bats early in the season. And so now you're starting to see, as he gets more playing time a little more consistently, this is a little more of what we've seen from Riley Adams throughout his career. He's not, you know, the greatest catcher in the world. He's not going to be always your greatest hitter. But the Riley Adams that we've seen for a long time, where he's really, really struggling at the plate, that hadn't been what he'd been throughout his career. So to see him get back to more the guy that's going to come up in some big spots and come through, show a little bit of power, but just be a reasonable enough big league type catcher, that's more the guy we've seen throughout his career than the other. So it's good to see him kind of get back on track and show that he's still got it in there.
Yeah, nobody thinks he should necessarily be a long-term answer or starter or anything. He's 29 years old. I just think they're getting production from the catching position, and they weren't before. Like, this was through, what, two-thirds of the season, the All-Star break, whatever it was the team that had by far the worst offensive and defensive catching metrics in the sport. And when you can't get anything out of the catcher, you're playing 8-on-9. It's a penalty kill in baseball, essentially, right? And so it's no longer a net minus for the moment the way Adams is playing. Frankly, organizationally, it's one of the things they've got to figure out, whether it's Caleb Lomavita, who is playing in the minor leagues and probably still a year away, or somebody else. They have to either upgrade that position in free agency at some point, or by way of, you know, the minor league system, to get more out of that spot than they have the last couple of years. James Wood, the discourse on him is long been annoying to me, and I try not to dabble into it or really pay much attention to it. But the idea of people that are kind of panicking or worrying about what he's become this year, look, there's no sugarcoating it. It's a bad six or so weeks for him. This is not James Wood-esque. You know, he is a big 6'7" guy with long levers who's going to strike out. We've always known that. He's striking out at an alarming rate during this run, and he hasn't hit nearly as well, had the approach that he typically has. He's chased more. Like, all of those things are true. And we got to find out why. That is the gig. There's no doubt about it. That is, you know, what needs to happen now is you talk to hitting instructors and coaches and people with the Nats and figure out why can't he get right and why can't he get out of this. But I just think this is a conversation about, like, right now and what's happening in this moment that doesn't need to be that much bigger than that. You know, the idea to extrapolate this out over, oh, well, this is what he's going to be, or whatever these conversations that I see are, people that are nervous or worried, I think it's all silly. We don't talk and contextualize enough as a fan base in these dialogues, from what I can see. He's the best player on a baseball team as a 22-year-old. He's the marked man in this lineup, and a lot of days is a one-man wrecking crew. You know, as good a player as, like, C.J. Abrams is, who's probably the second-best player they've got, he goes through significant ruts where he's not that hard to pitch to. You wonder kind of what is his plan. I mean, this is a player on an offense where there's nobody else that the defensive coordinator every single day decides this guy's not going to get yards against us, right? And that's what James Wood at 22 is dealing with in a big league lineup in a long summer while he's fatigued and worn down playing every day to this extent in the major leagues for the first time. So I'll be fascinated to see how he finishes. I want to see him make adjustments. I want to see him grind through this. And if he finishes strong, you know, he could end up with close to 40 home runs or 37 home runs or something. But he is on pace right now, Toby, for 33 jacks and 105 runs batted in a year where he's going to have an OPS upwards of nearly 850. I just saw a list that came out, I think from MLB Network, actually, maybe the Shredder or one of their analytics shows with, like, Brian Kenny or something, where they ranked the top 10 left fielders in baseball. James Wood was number one. So I can't tell you, there's generally a toxicity to social media, and, you know, I try not to get overly involved with, like, some of the negativity. I know it's not that fun being a Nats fan right now, but anything other than, wow, what an amazing season James Wood has had so far, is hard for me. It's not cheerleading. It's not pom-poms. It's just, I'll just point to the numbers. I don't need to say anything. Now, has it been a bad 6 weeks? Yes. Evening out of that. That's how averages work. This is how he was basically a top five hitter in baseball for a few months at 22, which is crazy. Was at playing it literally was like fourth, I think, in MVP odds at one point in the National League when he got named to the Derby. And now he's crashed back down to earth, and it's just going to end up being a generally amazing All-Star season. Man, I hope people will forgive him for that.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's one of those things that you don't need to rush to crazy conclusions about James Wood. Yes, it's been a very, very bad stretch. There's no way around it. I mean, if you're watching the ball games at times, it's a painful watch with his at-bats and the amount of times that I'm frustrated that you see him take strike three. And it can be on a pitch that you're like, why is that not something that you're sitting on looking for? You can get a fastball, you know, somewhere down the middle and he's still taking it for strike three. It's frustrating. I understand all those things. And we have those same sorts of feelings that a lot of fans do. But we also understand too, Grant, that this is a 162-game season. There's going to be ups and downs. And he'd been so good in the first half, like you said, you'd love to see him continue it. But if he can find a way to get things going for the final month and a half of season, he's still going to have ridiculous numbers regardless of what happens. I mean, he's still finishing the year with at least 26 homers because he hit his 26th Thursday as we record this earlier today. He's going to finish with 80-plus RBIs because he's already passed that mark. I mean, he's well on his way to 30-plus homers and 100 ribbies. And if you would have told anybody that before the season, then they would have been thrilled with that. They would have said that's an incredible year, even better than probably a lot of people expected. And so there's got to be some step back and realize what you're watching. And to me, it's one of those things that it's frustrating in the moment, but looking at it, just kind of enjoy the ride. There's going to be ups and downs. There's the highs of the first half were so high. There's going to be some pretty low lows, and we've gone through some of those, but I think that he's going to adjust. And like you said, he's the guy that you go into a pitching matchup. I mean, just think about it. If you're a team that is in a pennant race, you're looking to win your division. Here come the Washington Nationals to town. You look at that lineup. You're not intimidated at all. You look at the pitching staff, and frankly, you're not intimidated. You're thinking, we got to take two out of three or sweep this series. Who's the one guy that you're circling, not with a pencil, not with a pen, but with the biggest Sharpie possible, saying we can't let this guy beat us? It's James Wood. And so they're going to be very, very careful in how they go about it. He's the guy that they're going to the pen to bring in the lefty because, you know, it's late and they're trying to secure a win. Here comes nasty left-handed reliever.
By the way, I was thinking about this today. That was one of the first times he's gotten to face like a righty out of the bullpen, it feels like, in a long time. And he immediately hits a home run. But you're right. I bet you, I don't know where to find this stat. I've got to ask around. But there was a stat I saw at one point recently of like the number of pitchers that a batter faces per year. And a guy, the idea is like oftentimes the power lefties, like a big Juan Soto or Kyle Schwarber type bat. It's a ton of pitchers because, you know, every time they come up that somebody goes and gets the lefty specialist. And I guarantee you, not only has James Wood faced way more pitchers than anybody else on the team this year, but like it is a massively significant difference.
Yeah, I forget what game it was. I think it was during the Phillies series. I'm sitting up in the press box and just watching as the game goes along. And, you know, part of the fun of baseball is kind of playing couch manager, right? Where you're sitting there and you're looking at, okay, what are they going to do?
Toby Kyrou. I get steamed up for Toby Kyrou. He but, loves making pitching changes.
Yeah. No one loves making pitching changes more than Miguel Cairo. I'll tell you that much. But I think it was the Phillies didn't bring in a lefty or didn't have a lefty ready for James Wood. And I was like, wow, that's shocking. Generally, you know, we're watching the game on Thursday and they're going through the bottom of the order. I forget who exactly was pitching, but here comes Brooks Raley as soon as you get to the top of the order with James Wood leading off. And I think to me, Grant, this is one of those things that in the season, it's kind of tough because there are the roller coaster ride. But to me, I'm kind of just sitting here and enjoying the ride. When we get to the end of the year, then we can kind of look through and say, okay, the month of August, that July timeframe around the All-Star break, he hit a wall and he kind of struggled. And we've heard that he's been quite fatigued and tired and those sorts of things. And this is the rigors of a 162-game season. That's the tough part about it. And you need him to go through this. And there's going to be some struggles. But the beauty of struggling in 2025 for James Wood, Grant, is what does it matter, right? Like, this doesn't affect a playoff run. But imagine if this team turns things around in 2026, 2027, 2028. Now he has some of that experience to build off of. One thing off of this, Grant, though, that I think, you know, looking into the offseason, one thing that I really need this team to do, and we could talk about spending money and all that stuff. That's frustrating, and who knows if they're going to invest heavily in this ball club. But the one thing that I'm going to ask, maybe more than anything this offseason, is I need someone to be brought in so that you can provide protection for James Wood. Because you have right now the flipping at the top of the order where James Wood is batting leadoff and you have C.J. Abrams batting second, I think C.J. is probably fine in the leadoff spot. That's kind of where I would like to leave him. But then you put James Wood at the two hole and no one ever pitches to him. That's why earlier in the year, I was totally fine with when they flipped him and they ultimately flipped him back. I kind of like where he's at right now. But please, next year, can you bring somebody in that is at least a respectable bat so that they have to think about pitching to James Wood? Please, because like we talked about, he's the one dude you can't let beat you if you're an opposing ball club, and you watch the way that he gets pitched. He doesn't ever get hittable pitches, it feels like. It just he's the guy that, like you talked about, gets pitched to all the time. He got rung up a couple of times against David Peterson, who has the Nats number to the nth degree. But the pitches that he got rung up on are sinkers that start off the plate and break back down and away. It's a tough one. And then he strikes out on a slider off of that. When you tunnel those pitches, that's just difficult to face. And so you want to see him grow as the season goes on. But please find somebody that can give him some protection going forward so that we're not always talking about, well, he never sees anything because it's James Wood and they're so scared of him. Put somebody behind him that at least forces people to have to consider pitching to him.
Yeah, and again, I want to keep reiterating, like, this has not been a good stretch, and there has been too much swing and miss, and there has been too much chase, and he has regressed over these 6 weeks. But, you know, twofold. One, I think the conversation is just dramatically excessive. I mean, it's just the conversations of his demise are greatly exaggerated, number one. Number two, little perspective, please, people. I mean, comp him at this point, this many games in, to Soto or Harper. He stacks up very favorably. The year he's having is astoundingly impressive, even with this stretch. And if you look at the numbers, like, there's basically two categories where he's been bad, in air quotes, right? Which is whiff percentage, swing and miss, at about 32%, and then strikeout rate, fourth percentile, which is around 30% right now. Otherwise, he's elite, like off the charts good at this age, at this point of his career. When you're talking about average exit velo, 96th percentile, barrel percentage, 94th, hard hit percentage, 96th, bat speed, 95th, walk percentage, 90th. You know, there aren't teams would give up, you know, their top four or five guys in their system all over baseball to add this player right now. And I'm not trying to sit here and act like Nats fans are down and out, but I just see annoying things like body language police and all kinds of nonsense about his stretch. And
yeah, which
you knew
great.
This was coming. I mean, this is something I talked about last year. Like, he's a guy that he is a very low energy, like low smile. It just is personality. And like, this has been his entire career. I remember reading about this in the Post. I've talked to his parents about it. It's been a few years since I have. But like, this is something dating back to high school. He's been knocked for, like, is he running hard? His coaches would get upset. Is he trying? Is he? And it's like, his whole part of it is his demeanor. He's just a kind of a, hey, how you doing, Toby? Good to see you. Kind of like the Norwal and Elf or something, right?
Well, I mean,
hey, buddy, I hope you find your dad. But also, a big part of it is, like, he's running easy. It's like an effortless pitcher with velocity. Like, you can't see it. And, oh, by the way, he just posted the fastest sprint time of anybody on the team this week.
I mean, it's interesting because there was even a, you know, when he was going down to Atlanta for the All-Star game, I'd heard that people were like, hey, just because new people are going to be dealing with him in terms of the media. And like, he's not being a jerk. He's not trying to blow you off. That's just what James Wood does. That's how he talks. That's the way that he conducts himself. And that's kind of what I've talked about, where they needed that energy back with a Dylan Cruz. Cause you know, people are getting frustrated with a James for not showing the energy and CJ, but that's not who they are. I don't want them to try to be something that they're not. If James somehow turns into a rah-rah guy, I think we'd all understand that's not who James Wood is. Part of his ability, and maybe, you know, once they get to a point where this ball club is really, really good again and he's a superstar on it. I mean, Grant, part of the thing is the fact that he could come up in Game 7 of the World Series down by a run needing to come through, or he can show up in spring training and it's, you know, who cares pitching, and it's the same James Wood. It's the same mentality. It's the same.
What's who cares his stuff look like? Last time I saw him in the minors, he was struggling with his command.
Yeah, exactly.
You were looking at me like you didn't get my dad joke.
No, but I think
there was
you
a
get my
on
point.
First bit laying there. I had to take it.
He's got the same sort of level-headed, easygoing. We applaud so many athletes around different sports for having that, and James Wood has that. So if you're going to get frustrated that he's not showing more emotion and like, I need to show him, he need to pretend like he cares, he cares. I can promise you he cares. But that's just who James Wood is. And so if that's what you're going to get frustrated about, then you need to understand who he is. And if you don't get it then I can't help you.
Yeah, it's I can't fathom being a Nats fan in 2025 watching this shebingus of a season and having James Wood come up and not having an immensely positive reaction. Right?
By the way,
yeah.
Can I say something real quick if we're going to be scolding Nats fans real quick? I heard a smattering, and I say smattering because it was very, very few, but it felt like I heard a few boos when Juan Soto walked to the plate. Please don't do that. We've had the discussion about Harper. I don't know if we've necessarily had it on the pod before, but we've had the discussion.
Yeah, because we're
about
on different sides of that, I think.
Yeah, right? I don't care. Whatever. That doesn't bother me. That's all fun and good. Juan Soto, unless he ever comes out and says, screw DC or something like that nature, please don't be booing that guy. That guy.
Yeah, here's the difference, right? So first of all, I'm team don't boo Bryce because Bryce was a great Nat for a long time. And people don't really understand or have forgotten like how that ended. Whereas the team essentially moved on from him, not vice versa. 100%. But Harper legitimately was more willing to come back. Now he wanted to test the market. I know there's a lot of people that get bothered by that he turned down $300 million and then wanted to come back after the market wasn't what he wanted it to be or whatever. But the way it was always described to me, and I've had people tell me this on both sides of the whole thing, he kind of came back to them after he tested the market and they had moved on and they'd signed Patrick Corbin and they said, hey, the offer's kind of no longer there. But like more than Anthony Rendon or Juan Soto or any of these other guys that left, Trey Turner, whoever, like there was a willingness on his part to come back. Now, this does not matter. I don't care. He's now Mr. Philly. He loves cheesesteaks and Fresh Prince of Bel-Air and his favorite movie's Rocky. And he can kick rocks as far as I'm concerned. Like as a Nats fan, as a baseball fan, I still love watching the player. I still enjoy rooting for the player. I always had good interactions with Bryce for a superstar player. He was very accessible. I could talk to him about hockey or the Golden Knights or whatever in the clubhouse. And he was a cool enough dude. I always enjoyed him just fine. But my point is, like, my co-host on my daily show, who you'll hear with me talking to Mackenzie Gore in a few minutes, Danny Ruye, you know, he is team boo Bryce Harper, can't stand him, can't stand that he left. But his argument has always been that it was the Phillies. Like, if he went to the Rangers or the Astros or the Cardinals or the Padres, like, it wouldn't have mattered. And I think that's what's happening with the Juan Soto thing. You know, he was not booed when he came back with the Padres ever.
Well,
And when he came back after the trade, I think people said, oh, he was traded. He didn't choose to be elsewhere. So now, and I do hear, you brought it up to me today, and I hadn't heard it, but you're right. There were boos for him. And I think it's twofold. One, it's the Mets, so you chose to come to the division. And two, it's like that you've now signed. You had a choice to come back, theoretically, I guess.
Well,
you chose not to.
So to on both of those accounts, one, it's the Trey Turner thing. He got traded away to someone else, and in Juan Soto's case, you got traded to San Diego, then traded to New York, and then signed with the Mets. It's not like Nats fans are booing Trey Turner when he comes to the plate for the Phillies.
You know, Scherzer was the same way when he signed with the Mets. They never booed either of them.
To me,
but also, it should be this simple. Let's call it what it is, Toby. Did he win me a World Series?
Yes.
Then I'll do this.
Yeah. And like,
what are we doing here?
It was one thing that I was interested about, and I didn't think we'd get here in his first season in New York as a Met. I was curious to see over the length of his contract how the reception would be at Nationals Park as he came back to Nats Park time and time and time again as a member of the Metropolitans. Was it going to wear thin, or was he going to get an applause every single first game of a series, and he's going to tip his cap? And I didn't think that was going to happen by year three, year four, as time went on. But turns out by the end of the year, I think Nats fans are a little tired maybe of Mets fans, and in turn they retaliated against Soto.
Totally.
I'm just saying, if you want to retaliate against Mets fans, I'm totally for that. I'd love to join you. Let's do it to Lindor. Let's do it to Mark Vientos, who trashes this team all the time. Let's do it to Brett Beatty. Take your pick of anyone else. 22 of Juan Soto even if you don't want to clap for him, if you don't want to stand up for him, totally fine. Totally get it.
Soto is my favorite Nats hitter ever. And him and Max are my two favorite Nats ever. Like, straight up, right? So I'll do nothing but love that play. In fact, if you just say, who are your favorite players in baseball? And you and I talk about this kind of stuff just as buddies all the time, right? It's like our pastime. Like, Soto is still arguably my favorite player in Major League Baseball. It stinks that he's on the Mets. It makes it more complicated as someone who cares about the Nationals. But I don't even need people to, like, I don't need a nice ovation for him.
Yeah.
Tonight in the third game of a series in game number 15 or whatever it is back at Nats Park. Just treat him like essentially anybody else, other than, as you said, whereas you might boo the career Met or the career Yankee or whatever, like, you just kind of don't do either. Like, I'm not saying you have to be silent, but the idea of, like, booing for dislike, I don't get. I don't need everyone to act like every single at bat for 15 years while with the Mets is like his first time back either. But yeah, that was very strange. I was surprised. You said that was the thing that you'd been hearing, and I'm like, I didn't notice that. And you were definitely right about it.